our next guest, which I believe I have on the phone. It is Laura Tozer. Are you there, Laura?
Yes, I'm here.
Thank you much so much for standing by during my long intro there. But I was very interested to talk to you. We'd spoken a while ago about a paper that you had coming out, and it has now come out. And I actually didn't even realize at first what a great handoff from the first interview we did this morning. I don't know if you caught it, but we were talking to Andrew Gregg talking about wind turbines. And you're coming to us now to talk about a paper you just released called Community Energy Plans in Canadian Cities, Successes and Barriers in Implementation. So I think that's a perfect transfer over. Do you want to just talk a little bit about your relation to this topic? I have here that you're the Director of Operations for the Community Energy Partnership Programs. You've got several other accreditations next to you. Are you currently, is that your main outlet right now, is through CEPP?
That's right. So through the CEPP, that actually is administered by a not-for-profit organization called the Community Power Fund. And that not-for-profit organization is focused on enabling community-owned renewable energy development. But the research that was behind this paper that came out was a part of my master's research at the University of Toronto. And so that research over about a year was the background to this particular paper, which was focused on municipal community energy planning in Canadian cities, five of them.
So it was released in the International Journal of Justice and Sustainability I have here. Again, it's called Canadian Cities, Successes and Barriers to Implementation. And it was actually very readable. I always sort of chill a little bit when somebody asks me to read a paper. I actually quite enjoyed yours. It was very well put together. With your permission, we'd like to put a link to it on the show afterwards so people can take a look at your actual paper. But many questions popped up for me. And one of the ones very related to the first interview that we did was the need to correlate adaptation policy to jobs. And that was something that Andrew talked about as well, was that a lot of the farmers were convinced because of the what seemed like an easy paycheck. So I was wondering if we could just start off as far as the issues and barriers to implementing green energy programs, of the need to sell people on the financial gain, that the greenness of it isn't necessarily good enough.
And it's something that's pretty common in climate mitigation policy generally, is people tend to add the co-benefits of pursuing these kind of policies, because what you're getting out of the deal in climate mitigation is often argued for economic development and livability in the community and, the reduction of the impact of coal on air quality and those kind of co-benefits. And that's what is often tagged to these kind of policies that really at their core are trying to get at a more sustainable system. And in this case, I was focused particularly on the energy support systems for a city and how they get their energy and use it in the community, whether it spanning fully from efficiency through conservation, generating their own electricity, but also land use planning and transportation, because what it really came down to is the cities were interested in the greenhouse gas emissions that they were producing as a community.
Now, one of the things that leapt out at me right away, or whenever you're dealing with urban policy and municipal policy, Canada is kind of not a unique case, but it's there are some special issues here that are specific to Canada, which is that if you've done any academia with relation to planning of any type, policy, you'll hear the language that's used a lot, which is that in Canada, the cities are creatures of the provinces. So it creates an issue here where cities don't necessarily have the ability in many cases to make the sorts of decisions that they like. Can you talk at all about the relationship between cities and provinces in Canada having to do with sustainability?
Sure, yeah. It was something that was very common in my research when I was talking to representatives from the five cities. They had to find pretty imaginative ways of meeting the goals that they had set as a community. In some cases, they were really interested in getting into generating renewable electricity within their borders for their own operations or helping people in the community to build their own projects, but they were actually restricted by the province from getting into producing electricity because of there was a particular company that's owned by the province that pursues that as a public pursuit, and it can't be done by the city itself. And from that straight through to building codes, cities don't have control over the way that the buildings are built in their community. So if they're interested in really progressively pursuing things like efficiency in new buildings because they want to really become the home at cutting-edge work and actual implementation, they actually can't hold builders to a higher standard than what the provincial building code would be. But on the flip side, I mean, you do have the opportunity at the provincial and federal level to implement regulations and policies that completely pave the way for cities to pursue the projects that they want to in order to reduce greenhouse gas emissions, but it's really got to be opened up to let them make that kind of aggressive change.
So not only are there various barriers, and I want to get into to some of the barriers more specifically, but there's also various parties, obviously, that are involved here. So giving you an example to start with, say I was an individual and I wanted to generate some solar energy, but my roof wasn't quite big enough. So maybe, say, me and some of my neighbors there sort of agreed that it was a really good idea. Hey, let's pitch in some money and let's get something like this, and we'll share the energy. What sort of issues might someone come across? So what sort of regulations are barriers to individuals or small communities that want to sort of put their own money in and get this started, and it's not for corporate gain, but it's just sort of a sense of community and a small village or something. What sort of barriers would you run into?
And that's the kind of group that we deal with all the time at the Community Power Fund. There's a lot of people that are really interested in pursuing these projects as a social enterprise, and as a cooperative, it's quite common to do a renewable energy cooperative in that way, where it's neighbors sharing investment, making a return on their investment with renewable energy near them that powers their homes and businesses. But the kind of barriers that they run into can be kind of daunting depending on the size of the project, because it's a lot of money, a lot of capital investment up front, and it's tapping into a complicated arrangement of regulations and policies. So you're crossing planning hurdles, you're getting permission to officially connect to the electricity grid, you're dealing with engineering issues. And then if you'd like to expand the investment into the project, you've got to market to your other neighbors to get them interested and involved. And then you've got a couple of decades where you're managing a group, a membership, with money invested in a project. So there's a lot of responsibility over time, even after the project is built, to make sure that everyone's getting the returns they're supposed to get, the reporting they're supposed to get, they're able to, sell out and new people to join and that kind of thing. So it's quite a complicated undertaking, and in many cases it's a multi-year effort depending on the size of the project.
So you were, in your study, you were looking at cities all across the country. Did you get any sense of ranking? I mean, I realize you probably can't go sort of down the list in an ordered list or anything like that, but what was your sense from the research that you were doing about better and worse areas where community groups, let's continue with that example, would be able to go about this? Is Ontario, with its green energy program and feed-in tariffs and everything, are they a bastion? Maybe is Alberta a leader? Was there distinct differences between provinces and major cities and in the ability to get this sort of project off the ground for a community group?
At the time when I was doing my research, which was a span of a couple of years ago, the leader was by far the communities that I talked to in Ontario, because of the framework offered by the Green Energy Act. It really does enable these community groups to do these projects that they want to. Now there is a similar policy in Nova Scotia, so I talked to Halifax representatives as well, and they're very enabled to do community projects there. It's specifically for community projects, their feed-in tariff program. And so those were the two places where the community groups specifically were doing quite well. In terms of the city's actions, the city of Vancouver I also spoke with, and because they had been engaging on energy and climate topics for longer than the other cities that I talked to, they were further advanced in enabling all sorts of energy management and energy generation projects, from things that the municipality was doing to encouraging private business to do in the community to actually helping members of the community do for themselves.
Okay. And so when we're looking at more of a specific situation, let's move on now to kind of the city. One of the things that you outlined in your paper was that there are lots and lots of programs, but one of the issues is that, not necessarily a barrier, but one of the things that isn't being followed through with, is that despite all the programs, there seems to be, compared to the amount of programs, that there's very little assessment and sort of follow-up. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Yeah, and that's what really brought me to my research, because there's a number of plans floating around for all of these great things that municipalities are planning to do, and they're ratified by council and held up as the goal. And what I was interested in is, I know that a lot of the time these municipal policies, when you go back and check on implementation, they're really struggling with implementing them. And that was what I found, for the most part, with the five cities in Canada that I talked to about their community energy plans. They had made really great goals a few years ago, but as they moved into the implementation phase, they learned a lot about what they were able to accomplish, and in some cases, even their optimism and drive changed, the focus changed in what they were being told to focus on, whether that was by a change in the political oversight or in the bureaucracy. In many cases, they were making new departments. So it was really shifting as they moved from the goal-setting phase into the implementation phase.
One of the things that jumped out at me as far as this, I was looking for news stories yesterday, and I came across an article in the Toronto Star talking about how the City of Toronto Councillor Norm Kelly, who's the chair of the Parks and Environment Committee, was saying to a reporter that he doubted climate change was even real. So with someone like that who is not in agreement with the vast 98.9% of scientists on the planet, can you talk a little bit about barriers as far as political barriers, being like policy or just political inertia or just straight up bureaucracy kind of slowing the process, versus people actually working against interests as part of the system? What was your feeling was sort of the biggest barrier as far as getting these projects off? Was it inertia or actual like an anti-side fighting it?
One of the things that the participants in my research told me was, when they did have success, they consistently pointed to really strong political leadership. So if you have a council or a mayor that is really interested in moving progressively on energy and climate issues, it really drives the agenda through the entire organization. But what they found is, across the board, whether or not they had that kind of strong political leadership, was there was a lot of battling against status quo within the department. In many cases, it was seen that these were green, it would be nice to have additional projects that have to come from some other magical pot of money that doesn't exist. What my participants in the research were talking about is trying to integrate the decision-making for environmental and social purposes into all sorts of different departments, all sorts of different spending decisions, so that infrastructure was not completely inefficient as soon as it was bought, those kind of decisions that were across the board. And that, they found, was very difficult because of the silos in the departments and the fact that these projects have in the past been seen as sort of one-off pilot projects that are just nice to point to. So when there was that strong political leadership at the top, it really gave a message to the entire organization that this is important to our business and our responsibility to our community, and so it should be integrated across the organization.
All right. So we've only got about 4 minutes left, and I have two questions for you. So I just wanted to warn you, so you can gauge your answers a little bit. What I'm going to ask you second is that I want you to give me an example of a success, because we're talking a lot about barriers here. But with the last stop on kind of barriers, with respect to the last interview that we did, regardless of where the facts lie on that issue, because as we talked about during that, there still is research that needs to be done. But I want to ask you, with that as an example, with concerns about possible health concerns about things like wind energy and that sort of thing, and this is, I should be clear to our listeners that this is outside of what you actually covered in your paper. I'm sort of asking your personal opinion on this, but is there an implication here that a barrier is necessarily a bad thing? Is there not potentially a concern of too few barriers and steamrolling ahead into something that could have negative effects later? So, and I guess what I'm getting at is in your opinion, from what you've looked at, are all these, is calling something a barrier negative, necessarily negative, or are there good reasons for some of these barriers?
Well, I think what I took away from just to draw on the research to answer the question to start with, what I found was, we know, as you mentioned in your entry to the last question, that there's overwhelming scientific consensus on climate change and the need to move as quickly as we can as our opportunity for action to prevent runaway climate change that's beyond our control closes. That opportunity, it will not exist forever. And so what we need to do is pursue greenhouse gas emission reductions as quickly as we can. Of course, there's always the responsibility to minimize harm, but we're talking about in terms of barriers are just inertia and status quo, and it's not in the pursuit of a vision of a city and a Canada that is livable, healthy, and sustainable in all manners of the all meanings of the word.
All right. So just, and I'm sorry to rush you through them, but I really wanted to get to the last question here. We've only got about a minute and a half left. Can you give me an example that the paper is called Successes and Barriers or Success and Barriers? So can you talk about some success that you discovered?
Yeah. In Vancouver, they actually were doing quite well in getting to the targets that they had set to reduce their greenhouse gas emissions. They had done the Olympics as all the infrastructure investment that needs to go into the Olympics with that kind of framework in mind, so they had really pushed that ahead. And then it was really interesting to talk to cities that were starting to lay the foundation for a whole different local energy system in terms of looking at combined heat and power and district energy and aggressively pursuing efficiency and conservation. So there is success in that kind of transformational change to the local energy system that I think is the goal of planning communities that are sustainable.
All right. Well, thank you very much. I'm afraid you ended that at perfect timing. Absolutely. You must have been looking at your watch or something. I want to thank you very much for joining us, Laura. We've been waiting for a while to get you on, and I was very excited to read your paper. I want to recommend it to people as well. We will have a link to it on the website after the show. And other than that, thanks so much for joining us. If you have anything else, any other papers, I realize that was a master's thesis, but feel free. Our door is always open. Please contact us.
Thanks very much. Thanks for having me.